Good afternoon, and welcome to Best of Health. I'm your host, Arlie Helm, and you are listening on KVMR-FM 89.5 in Nevada City and 105.1 in Truckee and Lake Tahoe. We are interviewing today Dr. Celeste Johnston. She is a professor of nursing at McGill University in Toronto, Canada. And Dr. Johnston has been doing a series of research projects on skin-to-skin contact and the lessening or decreasing of pain response in preterm newborns as a result of skin-to-skin contact with their mothers. Welcome, Dr. Celeste Johnston.
Thank you.
And the most recent article that you published, the most recent journal article that you published, I picked up on BBC, which we cover the BBC top of the news headlines here, and I noticed that you've done some checking to make sure that it's actually the skin-to-skin contact and not all the things that we naturally do when we hold our babies, the rocking and the and humming and so forth. But actually the skin-to-skin contact, which is actually decreasing pain in preterm newborns. Would you like to explain how that works or what it is about skin-to-skin that's so magical?
Right. We don't actually know precisely why it is so magical. We think that it has to do with temperature, that is, that the mother, but it has to be a combination of things. We think it's the temperature because the mother is warm, and actually what is also interesting is that the mother will regulate. Her skin temperature will change depending on the baby's temperature. So in one study that someone else did with twins doing skin-to-skin care, one twin was closer to one breast than the other, and depending on that, twins getting warmer or cooler, the temperature in the skin of the breast would change to match the baby. So there's certainly this thermal regulation that's occurring. And even though we keep babies warm in incubators, we don't have that really close matching that that the mother's skin seems to be doing. We also, in the study that we did, as you said, when we were trying to test out, is it the mother talking to the baby? The baby knows the mother's voice from being in the womb. There are other studies have shown that babies can recognize their own mother's voice from other women after they're born. So we thought maybe it was the mother's voice that had something to do with it, or maybe it was the movement that the baby is used to when it's in the womb, as the mother just moves about her natural movements during the day. But when we tested the mother's rocking and talking to the baby and letting the baby suck her finger, that was no different than if she just held the baby still in the skin-to-skin contact or the kangaroo care. And so, but still, we didn't take away the mother's smell, for example, and we didn't take away the warmth because that you can't take this away. So we don't know if it's that the baby in some sense still knows the mother, or is it just this this warm body that's able to thermally regulate, which keeps the baby, they're using their energy, at other times they're using their energy to maintain their temperature, and by being with the mother in the skin-to-skin situation, their temperature is maintained, they go into a quiet state, their heart rate comes down, their oxygen saturations go up. Seems to be almost mimicking the womb.
You know, I can imagine that we all know that if we rub our own heads, for instance, it feels good.
Right.
But if someone else rubs our head for us, it feels a whole lot better. And if someone we love rubs our head, it feels better still.
Right.
So there's a difference. You found a difference between just keeping a baby warm in an incubator and putting the baby actually skin to skin with its mother.
That's right. And so you're absolutely right. And there's a lot of literature on adults that shows that being touched, just being touched, never mind held very closely, but just being touched by someone that you care about will, for example, release endorphins. So that's one of the mechanisms that we think might be happening with these babies, is there is endorphin release. And we're doing some animal studies where the mother animals are grooming the pups. These are rat studies to see if there's a change in endorphin levels in those. We don't have the results of those studies yet. So we don't know if that's what's happening. The other hormone that might be pl- interplaying in this is oxytocin, which, as you know, is in the mother, but it's also circulating in the baby from when the baby was still getting the mother's blood supply and in the environment of the womb. So there might be oxytocin, which is related to, you know, milk supply, milk letdown reflex, those kinds of things, and related to physiological stability in the baby. So it could be some of those hormones that are released by being held in that skin-to-skin situation by the mother.
So the hormone being released by the mother or being released by the baby.
It's what the mother's presence is stimulating the release of those hormones in the baby.
Okay, so the baby's own pituitary then releases oxytocin as a result of that skin-to-skin contact with the mother.
Right. Or endorphins.
We've recently interviewed one of your colleagues, Dr. Patrick McGowan, at McGill, and he's been looking at rats licking their babies and grooming their babies, and versus rats ignoring their babies, and finding some epigenetic changes in the hippocampus when the rats ignore their babies, but the rats that groom their babies quite a bit, the babies are quite healthy and don't get these methylations, these changes in their brain.
Right.
So is that something that you know, can we prevent some kind of oxidative damage to newborns, do you think, potentially, by doing more skin-to-skin contact?
Well, I'm biased, but I think yes, we probably can. I think if you... Now, those studies that group, and I work with that group, actually, at McGill, and that's the rat model that we're using, and we have a couple of studies that have come out on the maternal grooming in terms of pain response, and particularly when they're older. Does the maternal grooming help them cope with pain when they're older? And we found that for a different kind of pain, it seems to be helpful, but not for the same kind of pain, it seems to be helpful, but for a different kind of pain, it doesn't. And but we're using those high grooming dams versus the low grooming dams to compare the response of the pups when they're older. And so I think there's something very fundamentally important and survival value to mammals being close to the mothers, and certainly we know that from all the animal literature. But I think what they're showing is that they're looking at what the mechanisms are. So that same group had shown, for example, that pups of high grooming dams were smarter than the ones of low grooming dams, and so now they're looking at what the process is that would show that. And so in the same way that we found that the dams grooming the pups in response to a pain stimulus that we give them when they're just newborn, that protects them when they're older from pain, and a different kind of pain. It gives them some protective factor, so that if you think about preterm neonates, which is the population that I'm working with, they aren't meant to be out in the world yet. They're still meant to be in that what we believe to be a very protective and supportive environment of the womb. And so the more you can try and mimic or put the baby back with the mother for that developmental period, then I think probably the better they're going to be. Of course, people have tried to have mothers do kangaroo care 24/7. And it's even in countries that are less developed than North America, where there's a shortage of incubators, and these babies won't survive if they're not in kangaroo care, and actually they have improved the survival rate. And studies in South America have shown that the babies, premature babies that are put in skin-to-skin care, have a better survival rate than those that are in the incubator. So when you're in a country that doesn't have enough incubators, and the mothers have to do this 24/7, or the babies have a less chance of survival, even then they have difficulty getting the mothers to do it 24/7. So in some countries, there are a few places in Sweden, and where they do have the babies, even tiny, tiny premature babies, in kangaroo care, either with the mother or with the father or with the grandmother or even some of the siblings will do it pretty much all the time. And the results aren't out, and they aren't really, they haven't done a really nice randomized study on this yet. But it seems as though there could be some benefit to mimic the situation that the baby developmentally should be in.
So they're able to achieve that 24-hour kangaroo care by spelling the mom with other family members.
That's right.
Get the whole 24 hours covered.
That's right. Because it's very difficult for a mother to do that, you know, especially when the babies are quite sick. I mean, they have them in the intensive care units, and so because they still need intravenous fluids and they still need things like that. So the mothers can't really get up and do it very much because they have the babies on them. So it's also not good for the mothers to be sitting in a chair in a lazy boy or in bed all the time because she needs to move and get, you know, not lose muscle strength,
right,
and things like that.
And to get good circulation.
That's right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Because what you're looking for is normal physiology of the fetus, and the mother normally would be able to do everything carry the fetus around inside, but once the fetus is outside, there's some limitations.
Right.
So the normal physiology of the fetus also is that we're assuming that the fetus is in a pretty much a pain-free environment, and then coming out to the NICU, which we can't really make that a pain-free environment.
That's right. Well, we assume that the womb is pain-free. I can't think of what would be painful. I suppose they might get pretty cramped in there, but those are the bigger ones, I guess. Or if there's multiple gestation where you have twins or triplets or something, they might be kind of poking each other. Absolutely, when they come into the neonatal intensive care unit, there are certain procedures that have to be done to keep them alive, and these procedures are unfortunately painful. And unfortunately, these infants do have the ability to perceive pain when tissue damaging events occur, like a needle going in. And if they are sampling blood for tests, in North America we still do heel lances. In Europe, they only use they do venous access with a needle, which is the smaller amount of tissue is damaged when they do that. I don't know why North America hasn't changed their practice to do that. It's been 10 years that they've known that venipuncture is easier on the baby to get the blood than it is to do a heel lance. But nevertheless, they have to have tubes put down their trachea so they can breathe some of the time. They sometimes have to have chest tubes put in, so you have to cut to get the chest tube in, et cetera. So they are exposed to a far, far huge number of painful events during their stay. It's getting a bit better, the number of events. People are trying to decrease the number of tests that they do, and they're trying to cluster, like if they need blood, they're trying to do it all at once so that they don't have to stick the baby as often. But nevertheless, it's not the environment that they should be in.
You say actually in one of your papers, the paper that you published in 2003. I want to quote from that neonates born prematurely who spend the first weeks of their lives in the neonatal intensive care unit undergo many invasive procedures, an average of 2 to 3 per day, up to 8 to 10 per day, without benefit of analgesia, and.
Right.
And then you talked about the increasing evidence that there's long-term consequences to that, and that pain decreases state regulation. So let's talk about what the short-term and long-term consequences might be of the continually exposing the baby to so much pain.
Right. Well, the immediate consequences are that the baby becomes physiologically unstable. So that, the heart rate goes way high, and then sometimes it just drops right off, and they have what we call a bradycardia, and they have to be stimulated to get their heart back up to the speed it should be. They also desaturate, meaning that the oxygen levels that they're able to get, through their body decreases, and that's because of this disorganization. They're having trouble organizing their breathing and their heart rate and all this kind of thing, and they're being subjected to such stress that this disorganization ends up with them not getting the circulation and the oxygen circulating through their body that they should be having. So that is an important physiological response. I mean, it's actually potentially life-threatening response. Because they're in an intensive care unit when this is going on, they don't actually die at that time from it because people are there to intervene. They're there to give them oxygen and to stimulate their heart to keep going and then to back off and let their heart rate come back down if it's too high. But potentially that is a life-threatening response. Then in the long term, what we're seeing, and I guess it's been about 12 or 13 years that there has been literature coming out to show that what we're seeing in babies that have a lot of painful events when they're premature is surprisingly a blunting of their response when they're older. And older can be a month older, like when they reach term age, or it can be 2 months of age, or even one of the people who follows the babies for a long time, Ruth Grunow, at the University of British Columbia, has followed a group of children, and also someone in Germany has been following children that were born prematurely and are able to track their development in terms of the number of untreated painful events that they had. And what we're finding is that they don't show the same response that a normal child, or child who's been born at term and not been exposed to pain, they don't. And in one hand, you might say, well, this is good. They're not showing a pain expression. They're not, when they're babies, they're not showing as much pain expression in their faces as babies that have not been exposed to pain do. And when they're older, they seem to be a little bit insensitive to, for example, thermal pain, to heat. And so on one hand, you might say, well, this is good. We haven't made them hypersensitive, but we've made them hyposensitive, less sensitive. And that's not really good for survival either. I mean, that's a pain in the natural world without medical things happening to you is a protective mechanism. You know, if you are too near a fire, you're going to feel pain from the heat and you're going to pull away from it. And babies who are able to express their state clearly to their caregivers are then going to have caregivers that can respond to their needs. So a baby who may be in pain and is not expressing pain well as a baby, the mother isn't going to understand that there is something wrong. And again, when they're older, these children do sometimes suffer. Now, I don't know if this is a fact, but some of the mothers tell us that they get injured and don't let anyone know that this injury is occurring. So it's not good. You really don't want someone to be hypersensitive or hyposensitive. You want them to have the normal sensitivity that protects them through their experiences.
You know, there's emotional pain as well, and I'm just wondering if that carries over so that they become less sensitive to social interactions and are less prepared to have that finely tuned dance between themselves and other human beings, where we give each other signals, you know, go forward, back off, and that's what makes it really very comfortable for us to deal with each other in social situations. And we all know people who seem to be less sensitive or sort of shut down to some of that emotional feedback or social feedback and seem to be less successful socially.
Right. Well, we haven't really, nobody's really teased that out. Nobody's really looked at that. I know that you know, some subgroups of premature babies do seem to have less social skills than their matched counterparts, but we don't know if that's to do with pain or other things that might have happened to them during their development. That's something that people want to look at, and it's something that I'm hoping to embark on in the next year or so, a study that would actually follow these babies and look at what happened in their pain exposure as prematures versus their social skills, their social interaction skills, their social affective development, because we do know that when pain is experienced, even in young people or people that aren't able to self-report very well, that there's a different part of the brain is activated than for the part that senses the pain. So what we call the somatosensory cortex is where the sensation of pain is, the nociception, which is the signal that says this is pain. There's another part of the brain that that is more the emotional part of the brain that also responds to pain. And in a study that was published about a little more than 10 years ago, in adults, they had the experimental pain where people had their hand in a, I think it was a bucket of cold water. It was some sort of thermal pain. It was either something warm or their hand in a bucket of cold water. And one group was asked to think about how awful the pain was and that they couldn't wait to get their hand out of this thermal pain situation. And the other group was told to think about something pleasant and try and distract themselves from the fact that they were having a bit of pain. And what they found when they did the functional MRIs in this, looking at what parts of the brain were activated, they were very similar in this somatosensory cortex. That is, the signal of this cold pain was reaching the part of their brain that said, you really should move your hand because this is painful, and the part of their brain that said, this is unpleasant. So the group that was thinking about how awful it was to have being exposed to pain had much more activity in a part of the brain called the anterior cingulate cortex, part of the subcortical area, subfrontal region of the brain where the emotions are, was much more activity in that part of the brain than in the group that was thinking of something pleasant. So that was the first study that showed that really there were different parts of the brain. And we're only starting to look at those different parts of the brain during a painful situation in babies now. We're just now starting to have the technology to look at brain activity in painful situations.
I imagine some of the people that are listening are distinguishing in their minds between physical pain and emotional pain. And I think some people rate physical pain as a more important or more damaging or more painful pain. And I'm not sure that would be accurate when you think about things like separation and whether that or the feeling of, I'll just put a word on it, betrayal. I'm not going to say that a neonate would feel necessarily betrayed by becoming a pincushion and not having its mother nearby, but a feeling of that there's somehow something not right.
Yes. Well, certainly separation is a major issue with all mammals. And so, you know, you separate any mammal from its mother, you know, rats, rabbits, cats, dogs, whatever, and you'll get protest crying and eventually withdrawal and eventually death. And so it's certainly a very fundamental, again, survival. If you don't have your mother, you're going to die. You need to be fed. You need to be kept warm. And so it's very basic. It's very fundamental. And I think that what adults think of as loss, separation, and loss, and the emotional feeling that they have if they lose a loved one, and the grief response that they have, is just probably an adult form. And we have words to go with it that we have developed as we grow. But I think it's still the loss of a life-sustaining person. And so people say, my life will not be the same after the loss of this person. And I think that's just an adult form of the same, it's just a developmental continuum of the same very basic emotion.
I know there was a rather horrific study back in the 1800s, if you can even call it a study, where some orphans were put in a group where they were not handled at all. They were fed but never handled, and their death rate was extremely high. I don't remember if it was 100%, but it was very high. And I think that was one of our first proofs, if you will, that there is this overwhelming need for a baby to be in contact with someone who cares for it. And then there was that rhesus monkey study back in the 60s. Was it the 60s that
Harry F. Harlow?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's his cloth mother, the monkey. And then since then, Steve Swomey has been following that. He worked with Harry F. Harlow, and he's continued the work to look at again, very interestingly, looking at the epigenetics of the young monkeys, and I think he studies macaque monkeys, but he has found that there's an interaction between the genetic type of parents that he had, whether they're social or less social, and the attachment capabilities with the mother. And so, yes, and all this is just saying that we're in some sense wired to be with the mother up until an age that we can survive on our own. And so when you're looking at the extreme example of a premature baby, then that really is extreme. It isn't even just keeping proximity to the mother. They're not even in the mother anymore as they should be. And so it's just, to me, it just reinforces that idea.
Do you want to, for listeners who haven't had the opportunity to read Harlow's research, do you want to reprise what those baby monkeys chose?
Right.
And we know that these neonates that we're talking about, because they're human, don't have that ability to, you know, locomotion and choosing and so forth. But do you want to say what the monkeys did choose, the babies?
Right. Well, from my recollection, he had the monkeys. They had a wire mother that had food. Like he had a wire about the same size of a monkey, and it had a nipple with the food in it. And then there was a cloth monkey mother that was a soft terry cloth that was the same size, but it didn't even have food. So they would cling to the cloth mother, and when they were really hungry, they'd run over and get something to drink or to eat from the nourishment from the wire mother, and then go back to the cloth mother. And when they were adults, when they were put in social situations, they had unusual behaviors, like they would, anything new introduced into their environment, and they would scream in terror and run around, and they would cling to each other, the litter mates, the monkey, or the ones that were raised in this situation, would cling to each other, and they weren't able to form social relationships like mating. They weren't able to have a mating partner like other monkeys could.
So clearly not normal.
Clearly not normal. That's right. That's right.
Despite the fact that they were able to choose a more comfortable versus a less comfortable environment as babies.
That's right. And one of the other animal studies that we've just finished, one of my students has just finished and has presented at meetings and is under review for publication, where we looked at baby rats. That's the model that we've used, where one group was raised by a high-grooming mother, another by the low-grooming mother, the same as the study where you talked with Patrick about, and the other was the others were raised artificially. That is, it's cute. The Allison Fleming's lab in the University of Toronto, they call it "pup in a cup," where they have this wheel with little cups at the end where the baby rats are put, and they have a cannula put in their mouth so that they can be fed, and they're brushed enough to keep their skin sensitivity alive, and they have to they need that stimulation in order to defecate and urinate, so they do that to keep them alive, and they feed them. So that's called artificial rearing. And so this student compared the high grooming, the low grooming, and the artificial rearing pups in their response to pain, and particularly when they got older. And there was some protective mechanism from the high grooming mothers in for these pups.
So again, we're getting back to the normal physiology of the of the newborn and homeostasis, that these pups actually need to have a certain level of contact in order to even survive, and then the more contact that's appropriate, the better their survival rates.
That's right. The question we don't know is if, when I said, you know, a human baby knows its mother's voice from other women, and other studies have shown, for example, a newborn, these are full term, a newborn baby who is lying supine, all lying on his back, and if they put, the experimenter puts his mother's breast milk or colostrum on a cotton ball and another woman's breast milk or colostrum on a cotton ball, he will turn to his mother's because the amniotic fluid and colostrum share the same sort of signature, that mother's signature, her biochemical signature in the colostrum and the amniotic fluid. So we think the baby knows his mother by smell, and so they prefer their mother. They prefer their mother's voice to another female voice.
So
they certainly prefer women's voices to men's voices. So the question does it have to be the mother that's doing this, or can someone else do it? Because in rats, so one of the downsides of using rat models or other animal models is you can crossbreed rats. You can put any lactating dam with a bunch of pups, and she doesn't know that they're not hers, and they don't know that she's not their mother. But we think that newborns know their mother. Now, how important that is or not, we don't know. And possibly the rats know their mother. We've not been able to show that. But does it matter? I don't know if it matters. And that's some other studies that we're doing.
I imagine, when I go camping with people, or I might go to a conference and we all share a hotel room, I don't sleep as well as when I'm at home with my partner, with my husband.
Right.
And, I think human beings are, sometimes we're offended by the thought that smell is important to that, and we want our signature scent to be Chanel, not Mom. But I think there's more and more evidence coming out that our smell of our partner is important to us, and it makes sense that the smell of our mother would be important to us, especially as babies where our survival depends upon that.
Right. And I think there again is this, in a sense, is I call it, it's almost Darwinian wiring, that a baby will seek and turn towards the person who is most likely to take care of him. That is, he will turn towards the smell of his mother, or turn towards the voice of his mother.
That's great to think that a baby actually participates in their own chances of survival by actually being attracted to the person that they identify as being the one who's most likely to ensure that survival.
Exactly. They're amazing babies.
And you talked about the fact that in North America we're still doing heel lancing versus venipuncture, and even though we know that venipuncture is less painful, what responsibility do you think we have both as caregivers and administrators of caregiving facilities to use the methods shown to be the least painful for newborns, and especially for premature newborns?
Yes. Well, I really wish I knew I think there's a tremendous responsibility, and I think it's unethical that that we are not practicing what we know to be the best care. And I have been involved for about 10 years, I've been involved in research trying to understand what it is that's keeping these changes from occurring. Because it's been at least 20 years that we have known that pain is has major short-term and long-term effects on premature babies. And I must say, I'm just finishing analyzing data from, we didn't ask people, we actually went into units and looked to see what painful procedures were happening, how many were happening, what kind, and what kind of analgesics were being given. And we did that at this point, it's 12 years ago, And we just repeated it a year and a half ago, and I'm still trying to get this written up. But we found that there has been a change. There has been progress. This was in 14 neonatal units across Canada, and I think a similar thing is happening in the U.S. We're finding that there are fewer painful events being done to babies, and so this is the good news. The bad news is that there hasn't been a tremendous amount of progress in terms of analgesics that are being used. So, for example, sweet taste, sucrose solution of 24%, it has a very strong analgesic effect. Well, very strong. It's about the same as kangaroo care, the effect size. But it is enough that the baby seems to get through the procedure without showing much pain or seeming to have much pain. And we know that babies can have this several times during a 24-hour period. And yet, and this is in the guidelines of the American and Canadian Pediatric Societies, their guidelines for care of babies. And yet, we're finding it's less than 20% of the procedures are these babies getting sucrose or sweet taste. And so I don't know why. I really don't know why. And we're doing a lot of work trying to understand why this isn't happening. And I think because you would ask any practitioner, you would ask any nurse, you'd ask any neonatologist or respiratory therapist or physio, do you think the baby should have their pain managed? And they would all say yes, and they would all say that they did it. But when you actually go and look at it, they're not. So I'm not sure what the answer is. I don't know if a carrot works or if a stick works. I do know that there was a time about 20 years ago when not all babies received opiate-based anesthesia for surgery, and they didn't receive good analgesic postoperatively for major surgery. And a baby named Jeffrey Lawson, whose mother was a journalist, Jill Lawson, this baby had a heart problem and had surgery on his heart and died, didn't survive the surgery. And the mother, because she was a journalist, investigated, asked to see his medical record and went over it with a neonatologist and discovered that he had had the surgery without anesthesia and that he had had I don't know how long he lived after surgery, but he essentially had received no analgesics. And that was at the same time that a study had come out of the UK by someone named Sunny Anan, who's now in the United States. He's in Arkansas now. But he did the first study that showed that babies who were having surgery, who did not have good analgesia care, were more likely to have complications following their surgery. He went on to show that babies having heart surgery who didn't have good analgesia could actually had a higher mortality rate than those babies who didn't. Now, that was for major surgery. My work's been with the everyday procedural pain, but nevertheless, this work was extremely important. And it coincided with Jeffrey Lawson's experience and his death. And so this came out, I think it was a front cover story on Parade magazine. And within 6 weeks, the American Pediatric Society came out with these guidelines. And by the time people started doing surveys, almost every baby, I mean, it's something like 98% of the babies that had had surgery in our study were receiving good analgesics postoperatively. So in a sense that when information gets to the public like that and where something so dramatic as a baby dying, probably because of the pain that he had, certainly it didn't help him to have been that, besides the humanitarian idea that someone could do something like that without giving a baby analgesia and anesthesia. And the response was that they thought, I mean, it wasn't that they intended to kill the baby, of course, or that they intended even to harm the baby. They believed that the baby was too fragile to handle the drugs, and yet they thought he wasn't too fragile to handle the pain. So it was an ignorance thing. It wasn't a malicious thing. But we've learned from that, and I think that there's enough data out there now that we have learned that the procedural pain is almost as important.
I remember I was actually driving to work one morning. I worked at a large hospital with a level 2 NICU. On the morning that the news broke, the American Academy of Pediatrics said that babies feel pain. And I remember, just the feeling that was so overdue, because it was so obvious.
Right. Unfortunately, it wasn't. People used to believe, again, it was 20 years ago, but people used to believe that because, the covering of the nerve, the myelin sheath, isn't completely formed at birth, and certainly in preterm babies, it's not formed. That the pain signal wouldn't get through, and all it means is that it was a little slower getting through. But if you're thinking of a heel lance, and your leg is only, 8 inches long, then it doesn't have very far to go with the signal. So even if it's much slower than an adult leg, it doesn't have as far to go. So they're still going to get the pain signal there. So that was a misconception that people have, and I happily say that it's been probably 8 or 9 years that I've ever heard anybody say anymore that they don't think babies feel pain.
Okay, 8 or 9 years. Well, that's something.
Right. I mean, there's a little. It's baby steps.
Yeah, baby steps. What would you like, Doctor? We're talking with Dr. Celeste Johnston at McGill University in Toronto, Canada, about her work with kangaroo care and how effective it is in diminishing the pain response in preterm babies. Dr. Johnston, what would you like us here on KVMR to take away from your research at this point in time?
I think I'd like you to take away that mothers should participate in the comfort of their babies when they're having procedures done to them, and if at all possible in the skin-to-skin situation. There are some procedures that it wouldn't be possible to. You can't put a chest tube into a baby while he's in kangaroo care. But for the venipunctures and the heel lances and even the suctioning, for most of the things that happen to babies, I think that it's important for the mothers to realize that they can have an important role in comforting their babies and take back that comforting role that mothers are supposed to have.
And because this is not yet a standard of practice, it may be best practice, but it's not yet a standard of care.
Well, it's in the new guidelines. It's in the new guidelines, the 2008 guidelines from the Pediatric Societies. There's a joint statement from the American and Canadian Pediatric Society's Committee on the Fetus and Newborn that includes kangaroo care as a method of care for when doing minor procedures.
And if a mother should somehow feel that she's getting the message that she's sort of in the way, it would behoove her that would be easy to find online and to read it and become familiar with it, and
yes,
to realize how
yes.
important her
yes.
presence is.
Yes, exactly. And I know it's very mothers are very vulnerable too at the time that their babies are in the NICU, and for them to have to deal with bureaucracies or something in order to do what we now have evidence to show and what is a natural role for mothers to take. It's really too bad that she would have to do that. But I think she could find the information, and she would probably be able to find an advocate on the staff, somebody who would support her in trying to do that. It might not be the person that she saw that day, but there's probably somebody on the unit or a group of people on the unit who would support her in that request.
And I'd like to think, too, that if she's fortunate enough to have a partner who's in this with her, both very interested in and a good outcome for the baby, that could be the partner's role as well. To advocate for her and to speak out when the mother's feeling vulnerable about speaking out.
Exactly. There are 8 published studies on kangaroo care for pain response in neonates, and they all show positive results. So so that's something that that they can pull on. There's not one that has shown any adverse event to it, and they all show positive responses.
Actually, that's rather overwhelming. I mean, to have eight that all show positive responses and no studies that show negative responses, that's an overwhelming vote in favor of mothers doing kangaroo care with their newborns.
That's right. We're doing a Cochrane review now on it, and which will be probably a bit of time before it's published. But certainly there are those studies can be found, and it's they just have to go to PubMed and search it.
Yeah, and for listeners who don't know, PubMed in the United States, it's a way to access a lot of journal articles, at least as far as the abstracts.
Yes.
And there's also Highwire Press from Stanford University.
Right.
And the Cochrane Reviews review a number of studies on the same topic and come up with a statement.
The efficacy of it. Yeah.
Right. So that's something that. That thanks to the internet, that everyone who can get to a public library or somehow get access to the internet can access now that kind of information.
Right.
And that empowers, and knowledge empowers. So.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Celeste Johnston, for coming and sharing your time with us and talking about your research. I think it's so very important for our future and for the future of our babies and our society. So. You know what I'd love to see? I'd love to see how your, if at some point someone could connect with your research and look at the long-term effects on the mothers.
Yes.
The mothers that get to do the kangaroo care and have that feeling that they are participating actively in the quality of life and the survival of their premature babies. I'd like to see what their long-term and short-term benefits or you know what kind of long-term and short-term feelings that, or health benefits or psychological benefits that they receive from that.
Yes. We've asked them. We have just asked them how they felt about doing it, and they all. I think we've had a total of. I think it's over 300 mothers that have participated in our studies that we've asked that question to. And we've had one that said she wouldn't do it again. And all the others, not only would they do it again, they actually insist that nothing be done to the baby unless they're there and they can be doing kangaroo care. And they all talk about that it was they felt that they were really being a mother to the baby. And they were initially maybe afraid of seeing the baby have something painful done to them, but that they knew they had to be there to help the baby. And they were so amazed at the response of the baby when they were in kangaroo care versus when they were in the incubator. They had seen it in the incubator, and they just realized that they really had such an important role, and it made them feel wonderful and like a mother. It made them feel like a mother.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. My pleasure.
Okay.
Have
a lovely day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. You have been listening to Best of Health with Arlie Helm on KVMR FM 89.5 in Nevada City and 105.1 in Truckee and Lake Tahoe.